It's said the color of spring is green, emerging slowly in scene after scene. But this spring, 2022, I honor the spirit of yellow and blue. This is Spectrum West. I'm Al Ross, springing into your day with news, views, and personalities engaged in the abundant arts, culture, and humanities of Western Wisconsin. This week, the author of a book about his experience dressing up as animal mascots, UW Stout Professor Daniel Roofman, is here. Emerging from a pandemic and making things better because of it is the Wisconsin Arts Board. Our guest is Executive Director George Sugros. An old friend of the arts in the venue that was the face of live performance pre-Pablo, Ben Richgruber, engages from his home in Hilo, Hawaii, to talk about his new life as a fused glass artist. And let's get the show on the road with this. Natalie Warren has gone places and done things that in an entire lifetime should suffice. She's already canoed farther, lived more completely, and cared more deeply than 10 of us other folks combined. And she's only in her 34th year. She shares her story and her passions and will do just that next Thursday in Spooner, Wisconsin. Her book is Hudson Bay Bound, the story of canoeing from Minneapolis, where she now lives, to Hudson Bay. That's a couple thousand miles by river. Today, motherhood, continued engagement, and teaching communication studies at the college level are just some of what keeps her busy. You almost have to be an educator. You have so much to share. I mean, come on.
I do. I have a lot to share. I'm learning. The best teachers are the ones that sometimes say the least. And so I feel like I'm at this point in my life where I've shared so much, and now I'm trying to spark the discussion and the conversation more so than doing most of the talking.
All right. Well, let's talk about the book and let's talk about the trip, because I'm sure you're pretty well versed on all that.
Yeah.
Yeah. You took this trip in 2011 with your buddy, Ann Rejo, and a dog. 10 years later, the book, Hudson Bay Bound. It's a trip that took you 85 days. I did at the very beginning before you got sick and had to postpone your Spooner event. I followed your trip on a map, iPad or my phone or something. And you know how that is when you're on a small screen and you keep scrolling, and it just kept going and going and going. And, you know, rivers have ways of going in the opposite direction that you're headed.
Yes, that is the case with our trip, especially. We left on the Minnesota River, paddled upstream during an epic flood. So we were only moving about 1.5 miles an hour. We could have walked the river faster than we paddled it. It is the slowest form of transportation. But it truly is amazing for this expedition from the Minnesota River to the Red River to Lake Winnipeg to the Hayes River. We had so few portages. And so to realize over thousands of miles how connected water actually is by traveling it, I think just really blew my mind.
You talked about the cutting across cornfields because it was flooded.
I think that was especially eye-opening. I talk a lot about our experience paddling through the Corn Belt in the book. And I studied environmental studies and policy and agriculture in college. And so I had talked and read a lot about environmental issues, but there's something about paddling over a cornfield, watching the corn sort of bend beneath your canoe, and knowing all of the pesticides and fertilizers that we use on these conventional farms, all of those are directly going into our water resources. And feeling that in that moment, I think really sort of connected the dots for me. I started asking questions, how can we actually grow food without directly polluting our water? There's got to be a better way, you know?
So that had to be better than any laboratory you had ever been in.
Huh? And I think my educational background probably helped me have a specific lens going into this expedition, but it wasn't until I was actually thrown into the landscape and having really candid conversations with farmers and people in rural areas and people who had very different upbringings than my urban background. It just started to open my eyes to the complexity of the issues.
Let's go back to the beginning. Your friend Ann showed up at your St. Olaf College dorm room door, tossed you a classic book about Eric Severide, the well-known journalist, and his pal doing this trip back in 1930, I believe, and suggesting the two of you do it as well. You've been paddling on water all over the place. Did this Hudson Bay trip start that attachment to rivers, or were you already into that and that's why it made sense?
Well, Anne and I met through YMCA Camp Minojin near the Boundary Waters. And so when I was 15, I came up to Minnesota from Miami, Florida, where I'm from. And I went on a 2-week Boundary Waters canoe trip. And the summer after that was a 30-day canoe trip in Ontario. And the summer after that was a 50-day canoe trip in Nunavik, Canada, where I met Anne. So this had already been something that not only was foundational to my relationship and friendship with Anne, but I had already fallen in love with rivers. But I think the biggest difference here is we had only been in wilderness areas and really pristine scenic places. And the trip that we embarked on, we're paddling through big cities. We are meeting people all of the time, and we really didn't account for the social component of the expedition.
On the phone with Natalie Warren, she took a canoe trip back in 2011 and has written a book about it, released last year, Hudson Bay Bound, and she's also going to put on a presentation at the Wisconsin Canoe Heritage Museum in Spooner, Wisconsin, on the 7th of April. There's a very cool hour-long virtual book launch video online that I got to watch, and on it, you get kind of emotional when talking about the trip. All these years later, is it the memory of the trip? Is it the solid friendships, the thrill of getting the book finished? What brought on the tears?
I didn't expect to cry so much at my book launch, but it's all of those things. And I think for that moment, throughout the last decade, there hasn't been a big celebratory moment. Even when we got to Hudson Bay, it was this very sort of somber, we've arrived at a place where we feel like there should be a big party or something, but really, it's just a historic site, and the caretakers go, "Hey, hello, we just paddled to Hudson Bay. Yay!" And from the process of writing it was in some ways even more challenging than the expedition itself. I was working full time on the St. Croix River, doing environmental policy work, and then I would come home and write my book and balance a lot of these life things. And even through the book publishing process, I was courted by the University of Minnesota Press. Finally, they gave me a contract, but then I was like, oh gosh, I actually have to finish writing this. And so every part, there was always more to do. It hit me at that moment at my book launch. I was sort of done. I was holding the book that I had written about this expedition that in many ways had shaped my life over the last decade. And I definitely felt the breadth of that emotion at that moment.
Yeah, well, understandable. It was neat to watch. So, you have your naturalist hat on now, Natalie the Naturalist. You've already mentioned the fact that you're a city girl in Miami, of all places, which is kind of a tinsel town. The show was called Miami Vice, after all. Natalie the Naturalist, when did she emerge? You came up to northern Minnesota at least 3 times as a youngster. Because I have spent a couple of years in Florida, and people don't travel the Florida rivers the way they do in the north, because there are some critters they don't want to run into. So how did
Yes.
were you like a cicada? You popped out every 17 years, or what happened?
Yeah, I mean, essentially, that's a great way to put it. I think perhaps because of my urban background and because I was not that person who grew up in the Northwoods paddling rivers and lakes, it was such a shock to my system when I experienced a place like the Boundary Waters, when I experienced the canoe as a way to sort of learn about the world around me and digest and take that all in. I don't know. I think I just saw things that I needed to share that made such an impact on me and how I perceive the world around me that I had to not only look at that, but turn around and communicate it. And I think that's when I started sort of wearing this naturalist hat. After paddling to Hudson Bay, I came back to the Minnesota River. And I was guiding canoe trips with youth, and we were
Oh, cool.
staying with farmers and learning about water quality and water treatment and all of these things because I don't know, they impacted me at my core and I couldn't look away from them. I had to do something about it. And for me, that has always been in this realm of education and communication.
Yeah, and what I like about you is you do it with energy, and you do it with a smile. You're a mom now. What about itches to do something crazy? Is that itch still there? And secondarily, do you see yourself passing along that karma to your offspring as you age?
Yeah, being a mom is a very different identity for me. People told me, oh, you know, you've paddled the Hudson Bay, you've done all these big trips, you'll do fine. And it's been really challenging because I've lived my life all throughout my 20s, and I'm going to be 34 this year. Really,
wow,
doing
you're
whatever
getting
I,
old, Natalie.
I'm getting old. I know. It's true. But I lived so impulsively for so long. My identity was really shaped on going on all of these adventures, paddling to Hudson Bay, paddling the Mississippi River, paddling the Yukon River. And, you know, every few years I was able to leave for sometimes months at a time. Now, as a mother, that's not something I even want to do at this point. I want to be home and build my family and be there for my daughter. So I've had to sort of shift how I view outdoor recreation parts of my identity to incorporate canoeing and biking and all those things more into my daily life. I live 2 miles away from the Mississippi River, and I try to get out as much as possible, whereas before I feel like I would just hibernate and then canoe for 3 months and then hibernate again. So I've had to find a balance, definitely, as I get older. And I hope, and my daughter's only, you know, she's not even two, so it's hard to know what parenting challenges and joys lay ahead, because we're really living day by day. But I am very excited to get her out into a canoe this summer.
Cool.
We have a canoe in our backyard, and she always looks out the window and goes, Mama's canoe. I'm like, yeah,
there you go.
We're going to go in it soon.
Yeah, so I'm excited
to pass that on, but
cool.
Also wary of being overbearing about it. So I'll hopefully find that balance.
Neat. This program is about the arts and the culture, mostly of Wisconsin, but we're crossing the border to talk to you, and we don't mind doing that. And I mentioned that because you're also a musician, but we're not going to take time to talk about that this time. But I know that you are doing pretty well. Maybe we'll talk with you about that capacity down the line. What are people going to experience in Spooner, Wisconsin, the night of April 7th?
My presentation has evolved quite a bit. I do share stories from the trip. I start my presentation by singing and playing a guitar. And it's a song that Ann and I sang quite a bit on our trip, so it holds a special place in my heart. I show a video and read journal entries and end my presentation with a poem. So my hope is that it's a really reflective sort of artistic experience for people, not just a trip journal, something with a beginning, middle, and end that inspires people to not only take their own adventures, but to really think about our relationships with place.
It certainly appears to me the Natalie of 2022 is just as cool or cooler than the 2011 version. Thanks for the book. It helps us get away, and it might just add some spark to an otherwise dull life.
Thank you so much. I love that you think I'm cooler now.
Oh, well,
I appreciate
yeah.
that.
I didn't know the old version, but I sure do like the new ones.
And
thank you for your dedication to rivers and the environment in which we live. I hope we can speak again, and thanks for your time this time here on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Thanks so much, Al.
Well, that was fun. Coming up on Spectrum West, being a mascot, arts, resilience, and finding an old friend. Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Every once in a while, we feature a little something we could call Where Are They Now? People who've been part of the Western Wisconsin art scene but have moved on to other pastures. And in this case, we can certainly say greener pastures, because Ben Richgruber, former director of the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center, now resides in Hawaii. Isn't that how you say it? Hawaii? Yeah, okay. He has reinvented his career and is now one of those he previously served and presented. He's a fused glass artist. He and I spoke on Monday. I'm going to say it's been a while since I put Ben Richgruber on my calendar. And no, I don't want to know what the weather is, because we have a late March cold snap going on here.
That happens.
You are on what's called the Big Island. You are in Hilo.
Nice sleepy little Hilo. Good point, town.
Tell us about the community.
The community is good. It's Hawaii, you know, like it's got a slower, more laid back attitude. It's a beautiful town. I mean, this is the side of the island that gets all the rain, which some people are sad about. But the rain gives you the rainbows, the rain gives you the waterfalls. So this site has a lot of great hiking and exploring and all that goodness.
The word climate comes to mind, and already I've noted that we're jealous of your weather climate. But in Hilo, what's the arts climate like?
The arts climate in Hilo. Well, I'll tell you, I moved to town about 6 months pre-COVID. So I got a taste for things and then it all disappeared for a while. But there is a scene and it is thriving. There are lots of wonderfully creative people. There are a couple of good community theater groups cranking things out. And then obviously lots of local and Hawaiian music and culture to really sink your teeth into, which is great.
You're an improv guy too. You've been able to do that?
There was a little improv crew on the other side of the island over in Kona, and they went a little dormant. I haven't heard from them, so we'll see if they're coming back or not.
Was Hilo on your radar from Eau Claire to Hilo, Hawaii? That to me is a little bit of a radical move, but you might have had a relationship with it before.
I did indeed. My sister has lived here for about 15 years, so I was not a total newbie when I moved to Hilo. Although I was always here as a tourist, so being here as a resident is always a different
Oh,
gig,
cool.
but a nice one.
I'm glad I'm so curious. Speaking of that, every time you and I had a chance to talk when you were an Eau Clairean, we were so busy talking about things that were going on and things you were doing that we really didn't talk about Ben's bio. And I'm curious about it now because you're in Hawaii. How long were you in Eau Claire and where did you come from to get to Eau Claire? What's your hometown?
My hometown is Sparta, Wisconsin, and I went to college in Eau Claire, UWEC, Go Blue Golds. After college, I disappeared to Florida for a year to go work at Disney, because why not? And then I made my way from Florida back up to Madison and got in the hospitality business there. I was a hotel manager, ran a couple of hotels with Cornerstone Hotel Management, a fine company for all your hospitality needs. So I was in Madison for about 7 years, and then I saw the gig at the state. Jumped up there and spent 12 years in Eau Claire.
We could get you to talk about your professional years here. And professionally, it did not culminate as you had hoped, but I need to make a point. In my mind, your leadership was a factor in allowing Eau Claire to get where it is today, because you steered the old ship while the new one was being built, and that allowed for the kind of transition that we needed. So here's a public thank you.
Well, thank you very much. I was putting some thought into that when you reached out. I did get to do a lot of really cool stuff. Most people don't get to do all of that in a whole career, and I got the opportunity to do a lot of cool stuff in a, pretty tight span of time there. So, walk around town and see things, touch things that I had a hand in, and that's cool. And that's not to like brag and say, look what I did, but Eau
No,
Claire's
no,
cool
no.
like that. If you want to come to the
No.
table, you get to sit at the table.
Yeah, no, your initials are on a bunch of stuff here. Good for you. Ben Richgerber on the phone with us, formerly executive director of the Eau Claire Regional Arts Center. That, of course, if it's too long ago for you to remember, was the State Theater and the Janet Carson Gallery, and who knows what else. He is the guy who specialized in keeping a sow's ear feeling like a silk purse, folks.
Lots of duct tape.
Now he is a glass artist, and he lives in Hilo, Hawaii, on the Big Island of Hawaii. If I'm not mistaken, you took a class from Mel Sunby at one time, didn't you?
I love Mel Sunby. He's the greatest man alive. Yes, I took multiple pottery classes from Mel and really enjoyed getting my hands in the mud. He taught me about raku, and we'd sit around the kiln and tell stories, and it was wonderful. That's kind of how I got my creative fix. Being at the state, I couldn't be in a lot of shows because I was working all of them. So it was hard to figure out rehearsal schedules and all that stuff. So clay sort of found its way in as a fun way to make a mess.
And now you're a glass
Yeah.
artist.
And I have no idea where the insane thought of playing with glass came to be. It just sort of did. And there was a glass artist that lives up in Honoka on the Big Island here. Her name is Rachel Baker. And I reached out and she said, yeah, come on up. I'll show you what I do. So I went up there once a week for a while and was cutting glass, helping her with her work. I was hooked a couple of times hanging out with her, and I had already ordered a kiln and a whole bunch of tools and supplies and haven't really stopped.
Pretty cool. And your studio is called
Yeah.
Pico Studio. I
Yes.
got to tell you, I get
Pico
hungry
Studio.
every time I say Pico. You know, tortilla chips, things like that. Here's the statement. Pico Studio is home to handmade fused glass art, inspired by the flow of water, the flow of lava, and sometimes just the flow of an idea. Pico Studio is home to glass that is both decorative and functional. The name Pico, where'd that come from?
Pico is actually from my grandfather. He was an engineer, and he had a company called the Precision Engineering Company, PECO.
There you go.
So when he died, I got lots of random tools. We even had letterhead, all these things that said PECO. Hmm. So when it was time to start doing my own thing, that's the name I want. So got my grandfather with me all the time.
Oh, that's cool. Good idea.
Yeah.
Around these woods, we have names like Immerman, and we had Beezy. Were those people inspirations for you?
Absolutely. I mean, Lori and I are, oh, I miss Lori. She's great. You know, she actually took one of my improv classes, and that's how we really got to know each other, well beyond the glass that she had in the gallery there. Yes, her art is amazing, and I do often think of it when I am doing random bits of things. And Steve Immerman, like, we shouldn't even be in the same sentence. I'm reading books to learn how to do this. His art is in those books that I'm reading. Other than using some of the same tools to do what we do, I've got a ways to go before I hit what we'll call peak Immerman.
So Immerman is a name and a goal.
It is a name and a goal. Well known in the glass world. The pattern work that he does and the intricacies, very cool.
Your work is cool. Your website, you know, it's colorful. It's good stuff. What is the website?
Colors.
Yeah.
It is picostudio.com.
No, I didn't mean to be minimalist by saying colorful. It's good stuff. It's nice stuff. It's pretty. It's beautiful. It's...
Well, thank you.
Okay.
No. Thank you. No, I've had a lot of fun playing with it. Like,
good.
I started kind of doing the Immerman, like, inspiration with, you know, strip cut lines and kind of playing with the angles and things. And then I started to discover flow and let the glass do what it wants to do.
Glass artists impress me anyway, because the extent of glass with me is a beer bottle every once in a while. I could have a clear, a brown, and a green standing next to each other, and that's my glass art right there. You have your work displayed at various galleries on the island.
Yes, yes. What am I in? 3-4 galleries now on island, and I actually just had a random bump in with someone this weekend, so it could be 5 soon.
Good for you.
Yeah, that's exciting. I mean, these are places that I used to visit all the time when I was here as a tourist, and now to have my stuff in there feels pretty special. Other people see it as, you know, telling a little bit of the story of the island, figuring out how to make all those colors look right, and then get some really nice flow in the kiln.
Now, because you're good at it, I have to ask, is managing an arts venue a future possibility, or are you a glass guy now?
I sure like glass. I like not having to be somewhere until, you know, 10:30, 11:30 at night, paying artists and things like that. It was a wonderful time. I learned so much, and I met so many amazing people. All my best friends are still in Eau Claire and Fall Creek and Altoona, of course. Uh-huh. But, you know, it was a great time. It was super cool. I don't really see that happening. I wouldn't mind doing the board thing and still being involved at some level. But yeah, I think someone else can do that heavy lifting for a while.
As an executive director of an art center, what have you taken to a glass studio? How do you apply that?
How do I apply that? I don't know.
So I would think confidence is big. Yeah.
Well, definitely some confidence, not shy. But I think part of it is just sort of the business side of it.
There you go.
You know, once I started doing it, you know, I'm a spreadsheet junkie. So I've got spreadsheets every day that I fire the kiln, got the firing schedule in there, and I've got different spreadsheets that remind me what I did and how I did it, but also all the costs, because glass is an expensive hobby.
True.
And shipping that expensive stuff to Hawaii does not make it cheaper. I have to be very conscious of what I'm spending on it if I want to have a fair price for it in galleries. And so, yeah, I think that business side of it, I'm still me. I'm a connector. I'm a networker. I actually just started a group online with other glass artists on island here. And there was an art crawl last month, and we went around and met a whole bunch of each other. It was good. It's nice. There are a lot of us here, and, you know, the power of groupthink and group purchasing and good ideas bouncing back and forth. It's a fun little network now.
It really does sound like you're enjoying yourself. There's a bounce in your voice. Good for you.
Well, if you're not having fun, you're not doing it right.
There you go. Ben Richgruber, glad to hear that both feet are on the ground. There is an empty arts energy spot around here without Ben in the house, but we are happy for you. I wish you the best in your new venture, and thanks for speaking with me.
You bet, Al. It was nice to hear from you. Thank you.
Here's a Spectrum memo for you. The Heidi Center for the Arts online auction continues through Monday. It closes at 4 p.m. on Monday. The fundraiser includes unique items and experiences, and the online address is biddingowl, as in the bird, owl.com/Heidi Center. George Sugros is a good friend of this program and all of Wisconsin, one of the people who knows the arts from the inside and always available to cheer on efforts to improve access and appreciation. While the Pablo Center was going from conception to completion, he offered assistance from the organization he leads, the Wisconsin Arts Board, and during the pandemic, they were among several groups everyone looked to for resolve, reason, and reaction. There was a time almost exactly 2 years ago when we were a combination of deer in the headlights and sheep without a shepherd. But the strange and seemingly wonderful thing about the whole experience, it made us better at what we do. It added an elasticity and a hardiness that we hadn't displayed as often to this degree before. Artistic people have always been noted for always finding a way. This was not just finding a way. This was demolishing and clearing and constructing a whole different way.
Resilience was a major word that we went through during the pandemic because you're absolutely right. People had to think differently, do differently. You know, it's both the artist finding new ways to communicate, whether that was online or, you know, outside somewhere. But it was also the people in general who said, you know, I've got this time now. Mm-hmm. I can pick up that instrument I haven't played in a while. I can start to paint again. I can write that poetry I've been wanting to write. And so the arts were really important to making it through the pandemic, first of all. Now the challenge is to look forward into the future and say, so what are this stuff that we did during the pandemic must we keep? And what does it make us think differently about how we go to a new normal? Because it won't be the same. It'll be something different.
It always seemed as if in the old world, the arts, for the most part, always felt like it was a luxury. It was an amenity that we gave ourselves. But during these last couple of years, the arts, you sent me a quote, Stephen King said, music, books, poems, movies, and paintings, we not only leaned on them the last couple of years, but they became more of a necessity, don't you think?
I absolutely do. For some of us, that was always the case, but for others, it became crystal clear. Not only for our own humanity, our own personal expression, but then take a look at what happened to our downtowns. There were no shows going on at night, which meant no people going to the restaurants and all those other places. So it was human impact, an economic impact, a cultural impact. And I think we're also looking at that sort of social impact of we're distanced. We've been distanced for so long. How do we react with one another when we're in the same room? God bless Zoom and all of that ilk. We were able to stay connected, but it's a different kind of connection.
Pre-pandemic, everybody networked, everybody had meetings, but the agendas were all kind of expected. You can tell me I'm wrong because I know artistic people, they come up with things all the time. But then suddenly, the networking and the meetings, they had substance, and the agendas were life and death agendas. That had to be eye-opening, something that in your career, maybe you had never experienced.
No, absolutely. You're right. I think things get to be, oh, we did it that way last year, let's just do it again. We got the agenda the way we like it. However, couldn't do it that way anymore.
Right.
You know, how would you get people together on Zoom? All of a sudden, it wasn't just one person talking to a whole group of people, but there was interaction and you could have those conversations more specifically, whether it was based on geography or the kinds of art forms that you practice. There were all kinds of ways to do that. But yeah, how do I survive not just to next season? How do I survive till next month?
Yeah.
Those kinds of conversations become critical. And I have to say, there were new partners in the mix. Let's celebrate our friends at the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation. They really made a case for supporting the artist as business. And that had not been the case previous to the pandemic in a meaningful way. I mean, they had done it here and there, but during the pandemic, it became very clear that our economic development people understood the artists as small businesses, not just in what feeds our soul, but also what feeds our communities.
He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Arts Board. George Sugros on the phone with us here on Spectrum West. We've been looking backwards. Let's look forward now, the two of us. Tell me about Arts and Economic Prosperity 6, a collaboration with Americans for the Arts. I was reading about it. The last one was in 2016 and 17. Tell us about it in a thumbnail fashion, if you can.
Sure. Arts and Economic Prosperity 6 is actually, as you would expect, the sixth in a series of economic impact studies from Americans for the Arts and econometricians. I love that word, by the way.
Ooh,
econometricians,
yeah,
previously from Georgia Tech, now they've moved on to someone else, where they try to figure out the economic impact of both the nonprofit arts organization and the audience. You know, we talk about the nonprofit arts organization. It's the theater company running down to the local hardware store and buying paint to paint the sets. Well, that purchase has impact. You know, often people think of arts organizations as charities that don't have impact, but rather black holes that we throw money into. They're just charities. Well, no. They definitely have impact. And then when you think about what you do when you go to a show, and we talked about this earlier in the pandemic moment, you go to the show and you're going to park and you're going to have some food and you may hire a babysitter, et cetera. And so the audience member is having its distinct impact because they took the moment to go to that show. Mm-hmm. And so combining those two things helps to show the value of the arts. And again, the nonprofit arts in Wisconsin. What it doesn't show you is the value of the independent artists or the for-profit parts of the industry.
The figures from Arts and Economic Prosperity 5, the nonprofit arts and culture sector, is a almost $657 million industry in the state of Wisconsin, one that supports nearly 27,000 full-time equivalent jobs and generates $75.2 million in local and state government revenue. Where do you think those figures have gone by 2022?
I really think that the pandemic will have shown an impact. And that's important to note. Some people will ask, well, why would you do an economic impact study now when you know things are going to be down? Well, I think it's important to show how far down they've gone, if they've gone down, because people need to understand. We say anecdotally, the arts were the first industry to close and the last one back. They've been harder hit than most of the other industries. All of that is a story to tell, but when you have the numbers to back it up, it's really very important. I'm looking forward to it.
I think maybe our audience is unaware of how many levels support the arts. We have the local levels, then going up a notch, it's the Wisconsin Arts Board and Arts Wisconsin and those kinds of groups. There's also a group called Arts Midwest. It includes 9 states. How do you work with Arts Midwest?
It's been a really important place for conversation. It was begat by the National Endowment for the Arts. So you've got the federal, then you've got the regional, and there are, I believe, 6 regionals across the nation. For many years, Arts Midwest led the way with a conference for presenting and touring artists. Now, as Arts Midwest imagines its future, we're working to figure out what that looks like. It's crucial that we bring whatever issues we have to the full collaborative and say, hey, anybody else seeing this? Anybody else working on this kind of project? Is this a project that we can work collaboratively on? They also happily provide funding and also technical assistance. So they provide workshops and those kind of things to our constituents.
I don't think many people know how healthy the arts are in the Midwest. So good for us, huh?
Good for us, and good for us to have a mouthpiece like Arts Midwest to proclaim that, not just across the region, but across the nation.
Yep. I should cut this off, but I do want to touch on the Wisconsin Science Festival isn't until October, so why should we be talking about it now?
It's a great question. If you, as an organization, want to get involved in the Science Festival, you could begin to sign up to be a host for an activity. The Science Festival came into being a number of years ago now, and the Arts Board was a co-founder, because it's about explaining the sciences through the arts and humanities and explaining the arts and humanities through the sciences. It has been a statewide entity from its inception. The local library, the local university, the local pub might do a program during the time of the festival to bring people together to talk about science, either explaining it through the arts or humanities or vice versa. So it might be a play that has a very specific math theme or science theme. Or let's talk about the science between the colors that we use in our painting, or the physics of football, or the chemistry in beer making. So it takes the scientists out of the labs so that our citizens can know more about science and know that we have a role to play in it. And of course, throughout our university system and our private colleges as well, we have a lot of research going on in the state of Wisconsin, and it's good for our people to know about it.
So in March, how do people get more information on participating?
They go to the Science Festival's website, find the link to the forums to sign up.
Okay.
And the really great thing about this, Al, is that it's not something you have to create something new about. If you already have a standing event that takes place during this time and you want to associate it with the festival, you can do that. Or you can create a new event. But in any event, there's no cost to affiliating with the festival. It's just filling out that form and letting the festival know that you're interested. And then you get brought into the statewide marketing of the festival. So it's a real win for everybody.
The Wisconsin Arts Board, George Sugros, we appreciate all that you do and your time for being with us. Thanks.
Thank you, Al.
The partnership between business sponsors and listeners is a bond that is unique to public broadcasting. Wisconsin Public Radio listeners support companies that join them in support of WPR. Call Diane Nordell today at 839-2941 to learn more about opportunities to connect with your target audience.
Spectrum West on Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you along. Always good. Fiddle Fest for Tom comes to the Sawmill Saloon in Sealy, Wisconsin. We talked about it. Saturday from 2 to 9 p.m. Info online at truegrasstrio.com/fiddlefest. We'll have some more Spectrum memos for you coming up. For now, a while back, at the urging of another noted author, I checked out a book by UW Stout professor Daniel Roofman. He was previously published works of poetry, some nonfiction, and children's literature, but this is his memoir, or maybe a memoir, because it covers just a few of his younger years. Time spent dressing up as animal mascots for a restaurant chain, a hockey team, and a baseball club in his native Pennsylvania. The book is What the Fuzz? Survival Stories of a Minor League Mascot. Daniel Roofman. I don't believe I've ever heard, and we should take into account that I don't get out much, the designation Rhetoric and Composition Professor, although I did Google it, and it does exist elsewhere. After seeing that the first time, I thought, you know, that must mean politicians or future politicians would do well to take your course. It's persuasive, effective speech or writing. So as an English specialist, you teach young people what? Not only to write, but to do it with panache, or is that oversimplified?
I teach all forms of writing. So in my creative writing class, it's all about creative thinking and divergent thinking and trying to look at old topics in new ways. And then, you know, in first year composition, it's really just understanding, you know, how to communicate effectively in a variety of personal and professional contexts. So, yeah, it's overall effective communication adapted toward a variety of contexts.
That's Daniel Roofman, the educator. Now let's talk to Daniel Roofman, the author. The book is called What the Fuzz? Survival Stories of a Minor League Mascot. This is in addition to other things that you've written, and we'll hopefully touch on those before we're finished. And to think, Daniel, that it all started with a snap answer in a high school Spanish class. Now, without giving too much away, that's a foundational story I think we can tell our audience.
Absolutely, absolutely. So in high school Spanish class, I was probably a junior. My Spanish teacher had that basic assignment that everybody has. What do you want to be when you grow up? What do you want to do for work? Everybody was picking all the good jobs. And I was sitting in the back of the room going, oh my gosh, all the good jobs are gone. I police officer, oh, gone. I want to be a professional soccer player, gone. I want to be an archaeologist, gone. And so eventually it got to the point where I just said, you know what? I had to think about the most absurd job possible. First, I thought my dad's job, you know, he worked in mortuary and autopsy equipment. And then I thought, well, no, that's too creepy.
Yeah.
Then I just remembered, hey, mascots. Why not? Why not try to be a professional mascot? And so I said that, and the teacher was a little flummoxed at first, but, you know, she eventually let me write the paragraph in Spanish about how I wanted to be a professional mascot.
Yeah, and you did well. You got a good grade.
I did. I got the A, and then I went on thinking, well, it was just a joke. It's nothing to this.
Yeah, the book follows you then, taking it seriously, I guess, from a young career starting stint as Chuck E. Cheese. That's a large mouse.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Then to another level of performance with a hockey team and then a baseball team. It's mouse to otter to wolf. You know, that sounds a lot like a double play. But how did the urge come on to write about this eventually, or had this been an intention all along?
Not initially. I've always loved writing. The thing that really drew me into writing, especially like in poetry in the past, which is how I started, it was really the therapeutic aspect of it. You know, I'm dealing with some heavy emotions. What do I do to try to process that? I lived in a rural part of Pennsylvania when I was growing up and didn't have a whole lot of people around. It was just a lot of farms. And so I started writing as kind of like a way to deal with and process emotions and thoughts. And I was nearing my end in the minor leagues. I just had some interesting stories, I thought. I'd tell some of my friends about them, and my friends were like, oh, maybe you should write something. And I wrote it, and then I put it away. Mm-hmm. I looked around. I didn't see too many books about mascots. Maybe there's not a market. But I still wrote down the memories. It started out as journaling, just to try to process the ideas that were going on at the time. Mm-hmm. And eventually one of my friends who was a writer said, hey, you should really take another go at that because these stories are interesting.
They are. And you describe in great detail the atmosphere inside dark, hot, and dank costumes, and the history of meeting some marketing people, most of them on their way up, making up things to entertain the crowds. Now, most of what you did back then was for extra money while going to college. I have not finished the book, but I am close. I almost read it in one sitting, but it was Sunday morning, and my dog had other ideas.
Fair enough.
Does the book show the reader how the mascot path led to bigger and better things? What do you think that part of your young life contributed to the smart guy you are today?
It gave me interesting perspectives on life, and it gave me a way to connect with people. I think that was one of the things that I struggled with as a younger kid. I was one of those kids that just fit in the middle somewhere, and you know, if I just sat still long enough, people kind of passed over me and didn't really pay attention to me. You know, and I was pretty comfortable doing that. But as I got older, there's that idea that people have to take more initiative and more agency over their own lives. And I guess putting myself out there was a way for me to gain a degree of confidence that was able to carry me through to some grad school opportunities and perform better at job interviews. Even when I interviewed at my current position at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, I remember sitting in that interview and they asked me about a formative experience in my life. And I talked 10 minutes about mascotting with people on the hiring committee. Mm-hmm. Performative instruction, that's kind of how we have to approach the classroom these days as an entertainer. Learning how to entertain people in different ways and different kinds of costumes affects a lot of my poise and my strategies for connecting with students in the classroom. And so like the performative nature of that, the desire and the ability to connect with people in unique ways.
Yeah.
I think that's stuff that carried through into my career as an academic.
Daniel Roofman with us. The book is called What the Fuzz? Survival Stories of a Minor League Mascot. He has written other things as well, and he's on the faculty at UW-Stout. I can see how what you did as a young person with these mascot stints added to the confident guy that Daniel has turned out to be. And that's why I labeled the marketing people for these teams as people on their way up, because they tossed it to you and said, Daniel, you got to come up with something, man. And you did. The book has other ingredients to it. It's light, and it takes a turn towards the future as you read it. Some of the light moments, you talk about having your very first beer or beers.
Yes.
On your 21st birthday.
Yeah.
That was pretty cool. You helped me prove my age and isolation by mentioning someone named Red Foo I had to go look him up online. Had no idea. I think that was talking about dancing.
It was every mascot has to come up with a gimmick, like any celebrity. And Red Fu had the horn rim glasses. The Philly Fanatic came up with like the hip thrust and that like party favor tongue. So
there you go.
Trademark things that you make your own. And it wasn't any different when you're trying to perform as a mascot and create an identity, create a persona.
Did this book feel kind of like fresh air to you? Because healing seems to be a recurring theme, especially within your poetry.
Life is full of those ups and downs we all encounter. Growing up, I didn't have a whole lot of friends. I didn't have a whole lot of connection with people. I always felt like there was kind of a gap. You know, I didn't feel like I fit in a lot of places. Writing this book, it did allow me to see some of those eccentricities early on in life, made it possible, I think, for me to do more with this. You shovel enough manure in your life and like, this thing's not that bad. But healing is definitely something that's central to, I guess my mission in life. Back in 2016, my wife and I lost a child, Alistair. He passed away and there's always been kind of a void. Back when I wrote the poetry, Sleepbringer, that book was really about trying to find healing in the loss of having a child pass away. And then trying to parent other kids during that time. Alistair was the twin son of my middle son. You have this situation where, you know, even now there's still conversations that my kids bring up that like, I wonder what Alistair would be like now. It's like, I do too. Yeah. And it's a difficult thing. So if you don't lean in towards the healing, you kind of can get lost in the darkness sometimes. So
yeah. I'm going to guess because do as I do, not just do as I say is a mantra many English teachers live by, that you're constantly writing or as often as you can. Is there a formula that decides what gets published or do you try to publish something every few years? What's your sequence?
Well, I like to have a book out every couple of years. Lately, I've been just trying to write what I feel like writing. The poetry was easy to do. You can write a poem in a sprint. But to piece together a collection of essays into a memoir or to write a novel, which I'm working on right now, it's a little tricky to find the blocks of time that you need in order to do all that.
Lots of memoirs out there, some better than others, and I'm putting you in the better category. Congratulations on that. You obviously urge young people to write. Are there special ingredients to a memoir? Or if it's unique like yours, should one just start writing and telling the truth? And then after I wrote the words, tell the truth, I thought to myself, I should ask Daniel, is that all a memoir is, just telling the truth? Or does embellishment enter along the way?
There's a chapter, I don't know if I want to give too much away, but my boss asked what lengths would I go to support this team. Mm-hmm. And the next thing I knew I was in Altoona on the wrong end of a citywide manhunt.
Yes. Yeah.
And of course, all of this is essentially true. Truth is absolutely essential to all memoirs. But in the delivery, you can make some decisions about, am I going to withhold a little bit of information until the end of this chapter to create some sense of irony or tension?
Got it.
I think a good memoir deals with, yes, essentially truth has to be first and foremost. You're telling your truth. The word truth, you have the big T truth, the transcendent truth, and then you have the little T truth, the subjective truths that are our truths. I guess when you write a memoir, sometimes you have to be aware that your truth and your narrative might not be 100% what somebody else would remember in that moment. Maybe if you ask my dad, I remember coming down from Canada and, you know, getting the call that you were in the ER again. And I was like, didn't know about that. And he tells me about, you know, what the situation looked like. I'm describing it from my perspective on the gurney. And my dad saw a different perspective when he's walking in from vacation saying, you need an insurance card again. So my truth, I was still in the gurney. I was still getting treated for, you know, heat exhaustion on the way to heat stroke. But my truth is told in my style.
In closing, in addition to Nick Butler and Joe Neese and others, I am going to recommend this book as well. I had a wonderful time with it, as I think everyone will. What the Fuzz, Survival Stories of a Minor League Mascot. Our guest, Daniel Roofman, thanks. We look forward to your next efforts.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
You can read all about his work online at Daniel Roofman. That's R-U-E-F, as in Frank, M-A-N.com. Got some memos for you. Remember, the UW River Falls Stage and Screen Productions present the musical Cabaret. It opens tonight if you're listening on Thursday, and it runs through Saturday evening and then next Thursday, April 7th through Saturday evening, the 9th in the Blanche Davis Theater. On the UW River Falls campus, tomorrow evening at Pablo in the Market and Johnson Clearwater Room. That's tomorrow evening, Friday, April 1st, 7:30 p.m. UW Eau Claire First Friday's concert celebrates the music of Brahms. And then Sunday, April 3rd at 5 p.m., guest pianist Johann Botes performs music of Chopin, Chaminade, Debussy, and Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue for solo piano. The South African pianist is visiting from Marshall University. The concert's free and open to the public. Coming up next week, many voices will be raised in song, separate big events. We may talk about speaking Midwestern and about living newspapers in West Wisconsin, keeping them alive, maybe. In the meantime, keep in touch via SpectrumWest at WPR.org. Thanks, Rick. Thanks, Kate, for the publicity, and thank you all for being a part of this experience. Please listen in our conversation every chance you get. I'm Al Ross. See ya.